I recently flew out to LA for the NAMM convention, the National Association of Music Merchants. It's a giant convention in Anaheim for gearheads. All the latest musical gadgets were on display, everything from guitars, horns, drums, microphones, consoles, you name it. If you're a gearhead, it's paradise. Now, if you're someone like me, not a gearhead, it can be a little overwhelming and, let's be honest, tiresome. What balances it are all the musicians it attracts. And I met a mixture of friends in bands and people in bands I admired. So socially, it was fun to pal around. I also got to say hi to some of the companies that endorse me, like Orange Amps, Dunlop, Gibson Guitars, and Hagstrom Guitars. I appeared on Steve Jones's Jonesy's Jukebox radio show on KLOS and sang a couple of songs with Marty Friedman at the House of Blues. All in all, the trip was well worth it. I want to say thanks to Bjorn for hanging with me all week and Clay Marshall at M Theory Audio, our American label, for hooking up stuff as well. But for a long time, I've wanted to fly out to LA and do a bunch of podcasts. Since there are so many people that live in that city, I want on this podcast. I've always had a little running list in my head as to who I could do it with, and Ernie C. of Body Count has always been on every incarnation of that mental list. I met Ernie back in 2010 when we were spending a lot of time in Los Angeles, playing shows, shooting videos, and whatever else. He even ended up hanging out for our I Think Bad Thoughts video shoot. It's not uncommon if you hang around music types in LA long enough to eventually bump into musicians and bands, musicians and bands you listen to. And my history with Ernie C. goes back to 1991, when Ice-T simultaneously released his OG, Original Gangster full-length album and debuted his new rock band, Body Count, on Wax. He then followed it up by taking part in the historic first-ever Lollapalooza a few months later, an event I attended. Watching Ice-T, this pop culture personality I had only known from one end of the cultural spectrum, walk out on stage to twist, defy, and destroy all impressions we had of him was impressive and inspiring. One must remember the solid divisions in music back then, and when it comes to rap and heavy music, they arguably still exist. I thought it was ballsy and groundbreaking for Body Count to do what they did. We all heard Public Enemy sampling Angel of Death and Anthrax doing I'm the Man. We'd all heard the Bad Brains and the Beastie Boys, but Ice-T risked it all to cross over when he didn't have to. He couldn't have done Body Count if Body Count, the band, wasn't strong enough, wasn't good enough to do it with. I must have rewound that song Body Count 1,000 times just to listen to a band that I was so happy now existing. Of course, we all know now what happened to Body Count when they released their self-titled debut the following year, all the controversy that followed them, and it helped brand the band into the psyche of an entire generation. Full credit must be given to Ernie C., Body Count's main guitarist, musical director, and Ice-T's Body Count partner. After almost 30 years as a band, it's still Ice and Ernie. Still brash as ever. The one dilemma that plagues heavy bands is the inevitable deceleration as the years go by. While softer bands, softer musicians, can coast on what they do, growing easily into the pace of the sound they've set, heavy bands are always competing against their younger, angrier, and more energetic selves, and more times than not, fail. I can name a dozen bands off the top of my head who fall into this category, but Body Count, against all odds, seem to have only gotten heavier and angrier and more energetic with age. It's again inspiring. Last year's Bloodlust is proof. It was such a salvo of dense anger, even so far as to include a post-mortem Raining Blood Slayer cover for good measure. I must say, Manslaughter and Bloodlust, the last two Body Count albums, are so heavy as hell. I'm so glad they're still around doing it to show everybody how it's done. Ernie drove over to Santa Monica, where I was staying while in LA a week ago, to catch up, shoot the shit, and talk about what I wanted to talk to him about, namely Body Count. This might ruin his reputation, but Ernie C. is one of the nicest guys I've met in music bands, and this talk is one of my favorites I've ever had doing this podcast since 2011. This is why I always wanted to do them in LA and have Ernie on it. Thanks to everyone who has left kind comments about the podcast on iTunes. Please keep them coming. Also, this podcast is now available on Spotify. It's also available on SoundCloud if you have access to neither iTunes or Spotify. Okay, I've wanted to say this for quite some time, so here it goes. Ernie C. is this episode's guest on the Danko Jones Podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones Podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan get his Danko's go out to love for free. I'm so glad I do sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down. Down. You gotta listen to the Danko Jones Podcast. La, 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 la. You gotta listen to the Danko Jones Podcast. Do it in the morning, do it in the evening. Just make sure you do it today.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready, because the Danko Jones Podcast starts! No!
So, ever since I've been doing this podcast, the idea to come out to L.A., has been floating around for a few years. And every time I think about L.A., I think about only talking to you. You would be my first guy. So when the opportunity came, this is the first time I'm doing a trip out to L.A. with okay. no shows or anything.
Okay.
I had to hit you up and get you on the podcast.
It's great to be here. You know, it's great to be here. You know, L.A. is my city. I didn't grow up here, but I came here so long ago. I claim L.A. as my own. You know, I grew up in South Central, so I know the ins and outs of L.A.
Well, that's one of the times we were in L.A. Mm-hmm. You brought me to the Rainbow, like during off hours, and you gave me a personal tour of the club. Right. I tell that story to everybody who says, oh, yeah, man, we were hanging out at the Rainbow. And I always say, I got a tour from Ernie C., man. We saw rooms that people weren't supposed to see.
Yeah, the old rooms where all the excitement used to go on. I think it still goes on, but I don't, you know, party like that anymore. But, you know, the Rainbow is part of L.A. history, you know. I always say I worked my whole life to move 20 miles. You know, I grew up in South Central, now I live in the Valley. So that's 20 miles. I worked, you know, all this time to move 20 miles. Now I call myself successful.
Right. But, yeah, like, I also met you introduced me to the owner of the Rainbow.
Mario. Mario passed, like, yeah, 2 years ago. Mario passed, and Tony's still hanging around. So they're part of the woodwork, you know. Part of, you know, the history of it. I mean, Mario always tells me this story. You know, he used to tell me a story. He says, you know, I was the first guy to let a black person play on Sunset Strip. And I was like, you know, everyone thinks it's Jimi Hendrix, but James Brown was the first black man to play on the Sunset Strip. Wow. And Mario put him there.
That's really cool.
It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah. So when did you move to L.A.?
I moved to L.A. like so long ago, I hate to say the year, but it's in the 70s, you know. Yeah. I started junior high school out here. I went to elementary school back in Detroit, but I started junior high school out in California. And that's where I met, you know, all the... When I got here, I was like... All the gangs and everything I met someone that ran a gang. And when I first came to the neighborhood, the first week there, like the second day, he knocked at my door and says, hi, I'm Butchie. I run this neighborhood. My friend Chris gets back. You'll be fighting him. And I'm like, I was scared to death because I knew no one in the city. I've been taken out of my element. He's like, later on, Butchie became one of my best friends. Not really, because he was like a killer thug. He died at 19, but he kept me alive. Right. Because I played guitar every day on the porch. I played guitar, and he used to come over there and listen to me play. I learned all the happening songs, Jungle Boogie, Let's Get It On, everything that he liked. Right. I learned.
Right.
And then when the gangs would come, you know, to the elementary school, they get ready to fight. He says, "Ernie, you keep on walking." They beat up everybody else with me. I'm like, but he kept me alive.
Wow.
And he died at 19.
Right.
Just a fast life.
The reason why I wanted to ask you when you moved here was to place you where exactly you were when all this stuff in LA was happening in terms of music. And so, you know, you were obviously here then for all that 80s glam stuff and all the things that made LA famous a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, you know, that's, you know, when I first got here, I started going to clubs. When I first got into rock, I said, I need to learn rock. So I lived in South Central, and the first job I had was at Kentucky Fried Chicken in Hollywood, down the street from Guitar Center. So my drummer and I, you know, he got me the job there. I was like 15 years old, because I had a work permit. We used to come up to Hollywood. I saw a Van Halen play. I was like, what is he doing? I couldn't figure out what he was doing, because he was tapping the guitar. It was totally new to me. Then I got into listening to John Allen Holdsworth, and I figured out that's where he got it from, you know. But I saw the Blasters, what's his name, Randy Rhoads play, all those guitar players.
Like Quiet Riot.
I saw all those bands, and I was like, you know, I didn't exactly fit in, because I didn't want to be, that's part of what Body Count became anti-everything. Everything kind of came to us, because I didn't want to, you know, because I went and auditioned for some bands. I was okay at the time. I went and auditioned for some bands, like, you know, wear this, you know, like some spandex and this and that. And I'm like, no, that's not going to work out where I got to go home to, you know? People aren't going to dig that. The brothers ain't going to dig that. Well,
so, that brings me to, like, the whole thing about it's what made Body Count. Because I saw Body Count on the Lollapalooza tour.
Okay.
I saw, like, when Ice-T would shut down the rap part of the set,
right,
and you guys would come out. I saw that.
Right.
And there was something that, because Living Color was on the bill as well, but there was something that made me more proud to see you guys rather than, like, Living Color, in terms of, because you guys were heavy and I was a heavy metal kid. So
I'll say this, you know, and it was just a Living Color. Someone said Living Color is a black band, but y'all a bunch of niggas. So it was hardcore, but it's hardcore. That niggas, you know what I mean? Hardcore, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So not to be anything, but we're like, that was that, you know. People dug us because we were who we were, you know, and that, you know, I always had a problem. I let go of resentments, but I had when I first started this band, I wanted to be a part of a thing called the Black Rock Coalition that was in LA, you know,
yep, I remember.
And I went to go join them and this and that. And they kind of, you know, I think a problem with America segregates everything. That's a problem that I think America has. Everything is segregated. It's like, you know, when I went to Europe for the first time, I saw all the bands playing together. I thought that was so cool. Mm-hmm. But America likes to put things in boxes.
Like, it's so true.
You know, this box, that box, you know. And I went to them. I said, I want to be part of this. And they didn't want to accept me. You know, they were like, well, we got so-and-so going to play this band and this and that, this band. I'm like, what the hell? And so
this is after Body Count had been introduced.
This is when I was starting the band, before the band. This is like late 80s.
Oh, okay.
And in 91, when the band started playing clubs in LA, who came to see me play? Duff McKagan. You know, who reached out to me? Megadeth. Dave says, you know, I want to be on a song. You know, and I'm like, we just got him on a song recently. But he reached out to me first of all. You know, it was those people. So I was just like, why the black guys over there? You know, and I always sit. And then after we got popular, they called me and said, hey, you know, we decided to make you Artist of the Year. And I'm like, Artist of the Year.
Black Rock Coalition
made me Artist of the Year. And my drummer knew, because my drummer was my dear friend. He went up, we went there to accept the award. I'll go accept it. He's like, he was standing up there, just, you know, he damn near smashed it, you know, because he knew my drummer is basically the guy on the first record cover, just the angry black man. He was my anger, you know. I had Vic, and I'd say something. He said, "Oh, you talk too soft. Let me tell him." You know, because my drummer used to come, my bass player used to come late for rehearsal, and Vic used to be like, you know, I need to just go whack him upside the head, because I would be like, you need to get here on time. And Vic'll be like, get here on time or I'm gonna shoot you.
Yeah. But that must feel like a vindication. You must feel great that even though it came late, because I've got those resentments in me. We all do. If you hang around the game long enough, you build up these resentments. And sometimes, if you're lucky enough, those people come around.
They come back around.
And you just want to slap them. But it feels great, though. Right.
But, you know, when we were on Lollapalooza, you know, someone said that they don't like, someone in that band said they don't like the word we use the word nigga, you know. And we use it in love, you know what I mean? And so they had a problem with that. And
Black Rock did? Black Rock Coalition?
Yeah, the whole get down, yeah. So we were just kind of like, you know, just
but beyond that, you guys represented something for me. As a person of color, I saw people who were other people of color doing a music that I loved but was dominated by white people, and I felt like a part of a group, you know, like
I always said, you know, about playing rock or whatever. If you do it from your heart and you're pure about it, people will accept you. Like the Beastie Boys. No one ever says the Beastie Boys are white. They're good. You know what I mean? They Eminem. No one says, oh, he's that white. He's, you know, if you do it good and you're sincere about it, you'll get the respect and people will come to you.
Yeah, and then I get all surprised when these gatekeepers are these deciders. They decide what can come in and what can't. It creates all this stuff. You know, they can't see the bigger picture.
You know, the thing is, you know, I've lost three members of my band. Two of them died of cancer, and Moose got shot, and he wrote the song "Drive By," and he got shot in a drive by. I thought that was so ironic. But when I started replacing people in the band, people would always come to me, you know, and say, "Oh, you got to get a black drummer." I'm like, "No, I don't have to get this." You know, Body Count was just a bunch of friends that got together, and we just happened to be black. Mm-hmm. It was when we started reading the press when the band came out. They're like, "Oh, the black band." I'm like, "When did that extra title coming in?" Because we were just friends. It could have been anyone. It was just a group of guys that grew up together and decided to get a band. So when I started replacing people, at first I felt kind of obligated to do it. And I this and that. And then I lost my rhythm guitar player. I got Juan. Juan's a Cuban. And then, you know, I was like, okay, Juan can play. We like Juan. He's been around forever. He's in the band. And he's been accepted just fine by the audience. But we did a show for what's this thing called in New York? It's called almost a Black Rock Coalition puts on.
Oh, yes, I think I know. It's like a festival.
Yeah, it's a festival.
Is it Afro Rock?
Afro Rock. We did Afro Rock. And what got me upset was, you know, we had a picture in their paper. And they chopped off Juan because he was on the end. I was kind of feeling funny about that. And they did the article and they said Body Count, primarily black band.
Whoa.
And I was just like, what kind of slap in the face is this? Yeah, you know, do they want to start me up again? You know? Yeah. So I just thought that was one more time. Mm-hmm. America's segregating.
Yeah. From all sides.
Yeah, everything.
From all sides.
Everything.
But that's because it's ingrained, I think, in America. I see it just coming from up north in Canada, even though we're so close. I really feel it. The first time I went to America, I could feel the segregation.
Okay, it's terrible. You know, I grew up in Detroit. I was raised, it was me and my father. I'm only child. It's just me and my dad, and we moved in with a white Jewish lady during the '68 riots in Detroit. So my view on race is like, whatever, you know what I mean? Because I don't look at people in race, you know. I was a Boy Scout walking with a white lady down the street when the National Guard was in the city, you know. So I have, you know.
But your experience sounds very unique to me then.
Yeah, I thought it was very unique. When I tell it, people are like, really? You know, because she used to go to wrestling. I used to go to wrestling matches with her because my father worked for Chrysler, so he worked all the time, and she basically raised me till the time we left there and came, you know, from kindergarten to sixth grade. That's where I was, in Detroit, in the inner city, you know, doing in the '68 riots was the worst. And I remember, you know, I had no idea about race, but one time I had a little scuffle with a kid down the street. And they had 14 kids. I didn't know what that was. I went to the house one time and everybody's fighting for food. I'm like, oh, what? I'm the only child. I'm like, what are y'all doing? You know, so, and I had a little fight with my friend. And so I came home crying and Miss Judy said, let's go down. Miss Judy Ryan, that's a Jewish name, you know. She said, let's go down there. So she went down there and started talking to people. And they kind of got into it with her, you know, blah, blah, blah. And my father came to me and said, don't ever take that white lady down there again. I'm like, why would he say that? You know, why would he say something like that? And then I understood. Then he talked. That's when I learned about races, the way it worked. You know, I shouldn't bring the white lady down into the black neighborhood. Right. And, you know, I didn't even understand that.
Yeah.
Took me a while to get that.
It's funny when you say stuff like that, when you go to other kids' houses and you see when there's lots of siblings, because I'm an only child too.
Okay.
So we have a very interesting view of the world.
Yeah. It's like they would, you know, I didn't have everything, but I had what I needed, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like my father would buy me a bike and I'd have toys and things like that. And they'd come by and they, you know, it's just different, you know. Like I said, when I went to dinner there, I was like, you know, I remember one time out here, there was a kid, someone out next door to me, they had about 5-6 kids, right? And we were getting afros, and we heard if you put eggs on your head and you put shampoo and all this, it reverses perms, you know, just experiment with your hair, right?
Yeah.
And so I remember the best line, his father, we went over to his house, because I had, you know, we were doing it on our hair. So he said, let's go to your house, we're going to get the eggs and put the mayonnaise on there, some kind of thing that you put on your hair.
Yeah.
And his father said to him, says, go crack an egg over your head and see if it fills up your stomach. You know, because he was like, you can't do this with food. We only have so many eggs.
Right.
But I was just wasting them. You know, we'd throw them at each other.
Right. Yeah, I think I find that, like, only kids live in their head a lot. Because they don't have playmates as easily as like kids with a brother.
That's why we play the guitar.
And that's why we play the guitar.
We need something to occupy our time.
Yeah.
But you could get in a lot of trouble. You could, you know. Because
it's all in your head and
right.
It starts getting...
Right. It all depends where the energy goes,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
We decided to play the guitar. We tried to sit down and play the guitar, you know. So I know only children that are like wacky, you know.
Yep, I do too. And and that's the thing is like when I was... And I don't know about you, but I could feel the wackiness sometimes overtaking me. So I have to, like, not that I'm crazy,
right.
But there's,
crazy.
You just get, a little stir crazy.
Yeah, right.
You get stir crazy at home by yourself. And I would lock myself in my room.
I thought the greatest thing is when I started having kids, you know, and because I used to be lonely. I'm like, oh, it's just me. You know, you're getting that. Yeah, it's just me and no one cares. And my father passed and I was just by myself. It's just me. And I have kids now, and I, you know, and my daughters, they're in their 30s. And my daughter texts me every day, you know, says, how you doing, Dad? I'm like, I'm doing good, you know.
They don't have the only child perspective.
No, and that's so funny because I was just like, you don't know how lucky you are to have your brother and sister, you know. You don't know because I treat my friends like I think. See, I don't know how you treat a brother because I always say, I love you like a brother. I don't know how you treat a brother.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know how to love my kids.
To me, I've thought, is it how like we drive each other crazy, we fight, but we still are best of friends. Is that being brothers without from another mother?
I've never had a brother like that. I have like Ice, and I have a friend named Sean and Al that go on the road with them. I've known them for 47 years. They're as close as I'm going to get to brothers. You know, I've known them since I was 15 when I first came out here. You know what I mean? So, you know, that's what I think a brother is, in my opinion. You know,
yeah, I think touring, a substantial touring with another person.
Right.
And not breaking up or not leaving each other like you and Ice have,
right. We're
constitute
friends.
As
right.
Brother-dom.
I worry about his well-being. And, you know, I guess that's it. You know, more so than I worry about other people's well-being. You know, I really sincerely I care about him more than I care about other people. You know, if that makes any sense. I guess that's a brother. You know.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to rock.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we all know that you and Ice met in school, and but what were the connecting dots when it came to you and him doing music and this kind of music? It's so out of the box. What were the connection? Oh, we both liked
you know, the Beatles, or we both liked Zeppelin.
Yeah. Well, I always played guitar in high school. So, right. So, and I went to the Army. He went to the Army.
Okay.
And he had a, because he had a kid in high school.
I didn't know that. Okay.
He, Airborne Ranger, badass, the baddest of the bad. Airborne Ranger, you know what a Ranger is? Airborne yeah. Ranger, oh, that's badass. He jumps out of right. helicopters.
Does loads. He do that still?
He got bad hip, bad knees. So yeah, yeah. No, he don't do that no more.
He ain't doing that.
That's why he got a bad knee. So I used to play for them, me and my drummer that passed, we used to play for them when they used to break dance. Mm-hmm. So then Ice went to the Army after high school, and he got out on a discharge, and he came to me and he says, I'm going to start doing this music called rap. Have you heard of it? I said, yeah, I've been listening to it. That's from DMC's first coming out, you know what I mean?
Right.
We did Electric Boogaloo. Right. And Ice in Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah.
You're in that too.
Yeah, I'm in it.
Yeah, yeah, both of you guys.
The party
yeah,
people
yeah, yeah.
are the place to be. This is what you paid your money to see.
Totally.
You know? Man, with my double neck Charvel that Grover Jackson made for me that I still have.
Oh, wow.
You got that a bunch of cool. switches and buttons and stuff. You know, what's so funny, it's got everything. We're talking guitar stuff for a second. It's a double neck. And everything on it is split coil, reverse, you know, you can reverse the coil. Stuff I don't even know what it is now. Now I have a guitar with one pickup and no knobs.
That's right, I have one knob.
What, you got
the less knobs than you get.
Keep it simple. But anyway, so he came and he wanted a song. Then I started, you know, writing it. And it wasn't right. He went to New York. And all of a sudden he came back. And Warner Brothers, to do that first record, Warner Brothers gave him like $50,000 and no video. So, I mean, for that time, they were giving away millions of dollars to do records.
Oh, okay.
You know, during that time, you know, but they didn't know what it was. And he got signed by Seymour Stein. Seymour is like, you know, Seymour's the man.
That's like, yeah, he was on Sire for all of
Oh, he records. Owned Sire.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he owned, Seymour signed Madonna, Ice, Talking Heads, Seal, you know, good ear, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So then after that, you know, he did the two records, and I played on those records. It did well. So then he's like, why don't you do a rock band? I'm like, okay. So he gave me some money, and he went off to do New Jack City in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote some demos. I was going to be the singer for the band.
So he gave you money to do a band?
To do a demo.
But that's nothing to do with him in the band.
No, no.
This is your project.
It was going to be my project, because he was doing his rap stuff and you know, doing that. And so I did some demo stuff. I mean, it was like the basis for our first record. And I did some, like, The Winner Loses and stuff like that. I did those demos. And then we decided we're going to go out and I put the band together and we're going to go out and play. We have a video somewhere of the first show. He just came and stood on the stage to get the record executives to come. And so then I was like, I'm really just wanted to play guitar. My personality doesn't, you know, you have a different personality. You have a more outgoing personality. I have a more like inward. I just want to play guitar, and that's what I do, and that's all I want to do. I don't want to do anything else. I don't want to act. I don't want to do this. I just want to play guitar and go home. And, right. You know, do that. So then he said, I'll do a sing. He sang one song, and then he felt it like, wow. And he got the reaction. You know, you get the crowd reaction. Like, then we started writing more songs.
What was the song you did? One of your songs.
There Goes the Neighborhood.
So.
There Goes the Neighborhood. We started because we when we played on. So going backwards.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So we did this. We started playing around L.A. Right, and so then during that time I met Perry Farrell, and Perry wanted to do a song called Nigga Whitey, which is by Sly Stone.
Yeah,
I knew Sly Stone. I was a messenger delivering stuff to like packages, and I walked into an office called Lippman Kahane. They were a big time management company, and I heard Perry back there. I just heard an ear. I'm trying to do this song, Nigga. Why? I said, that's by Sly Stone. He said, yeah. I said, I know Sly. He's like, really? He says, yeah. I'm gonna do this song. I'm trying to do this video for The Gift, the movie his wife was doing.
Oh, his own thing. Yeah, yeah.
The Gift, right?
Yeah.
And he says, I'm trying to, you know. I said, I know how to get in contact with Sly. I'm the messenger. They brought me back there. Next thing I know, you know, they called me back the next week to meet with them. And then I was like, I can get Sly. And then I said, you know, I was talking to to the manager. I said, I'll do rock, and I know Ice-T and this and that. And so then we were trying to hook up with Dave, you know, because it was just me and Ice. It's just me and Ice. And so then he went to shoot the video that day. Like a week later, I talked to Sly, and Sly said, yeah, no problem, man, I'll be there, you know, blah, blah, blah. So the day of the video, Sly was MIA from, he was in treatment. He left treatment, and I was sitting at a rehearsal at the studio, and Sly wasn't going to show up. So they're looking at me. I said, you know this guy, Ice-T? He's like, yeah, we know Ice. I said, would you like him? He's like, wow, we'd love to get him. So I called up Ice. I said, Ice, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm in the studio with Quincy Jones right now doing a song called Back on the, Back on the Block. I'm like, can you come over?
That's awesome.
Can you come over here to Mate's rehearsal? Because we're doing... He actually really didn't know who Jane's Addiction was.
Right.
But he did his part for Quincy, and he came over with about 15 people. He came over. They did the thing. And it was just going to be those two, right? And so Perry said to me, he says, Ernie, you got a guitar? I said, I got one in the car. Because I was, you know, I'm a messenger. I kept my guitar in it. So we did that thing, that part. I don't know if you ever seen it. It's for the movie The Gift. And so then that goes by. No contract, no nothing. Just I'm here, Ice, bye. Right. You know. Yeah, yeah. And so then Perry was putting together Lollapalooza. So he says, I owe you guys one. So they put Ice on it. Right. And Ice says, for you getting this, your band, you know, the band that he's singing for now, they only knows the four songs we're going to play. That's why the band was so good at first, you know, in my humble opinion, because right. We only played four songs. Right. We only knew four songs. Right. So if we would have played for 40 minutes or 50 minutes, it would have been a whole different thing. We just played enough for people to say, that's badass.
It was, man.
You know, it was 15 minutes.
I can't, in my mind's eye, I can't remember how...
It was 15 minutes. He did a set for, he had 45 minutes. He did an Ice-T set for 30, and then he did the changeover, and we did 15 minutes. But it was 15 intense minutes.
It was.
So then when the record came out, it made the record sell.
Yeah. You know. I mean, of course, so you guys were all on my radar. Well, I had OG, I had Original Gangster.
Okay, so we're on that.
Yeah, I had that. So when I saw you guys, I was... Mm-hmm.
And that's 1990. That
came out before Lollapalooza.
Yes, that was on his record. And see, the thing about that is, it wasn't actually a band. It was just Moose, the bass player, me on all the guitars. We didn't even have D-Rock in the band. It was just one guitar. I just played all the guitars just to get the band, you know, something. Then we actually put D-Rock into the band later, and he was our high school friend.
Right. Yeah, like when I heard the album, you know, so when I saw you guys, I was like, oh, so this is, it wasn't maybe as a surprise to me as it was maybe someone who came to see Susie and the Banshees or something, or even like Henry Rollins or something. You know, it was just, I was like, oh, so that he's like kind of like segueing into this career now. But even on that album, I thought it was the fucking boldest move for him to do at that time.
And that song is more him because it's more punk sounding. The first record is more punk. Now we sound like a metal band.
You are full on metal. Now
we're more refined. That's why I always say, you know, the band is only, you know, 6 months old. So we couldn't do all those sharp turns, you know what I mean? The band just rolling along and it came out punk. I just turned the guitar up and we were playing loose handed and, you know, like now everything's tight and, you know, a little more tensed up.
Also, technology caught up to everybody too,
right? The technology caught up, but it's still just a little more tense, and then it was different writing, just a little more just looser, you know what I mean? Everything is just looser. It's almost strumming, you know, basically strumming, because he wrote a lot of stuff with me, and he's like, he would hum it, so I would have to figure it out like that. Like, he wouldn't, you know, a non-musician wouldn't write, you know what I mean? They're going like, you know what I mean?
But even before OG came out, on Iceberg, you were in the video for... Lethal Weapon, right?
Yeah, and also...
Like, playing guitar, so there was already of a rock element he was introducing.
And who else is in that video is Sonic Youth.
And Lethal Weapon?
Yeah, Sonic Youth is in that. And also, Dirty Waltz in it from Fishbone.
That I think I know. Yeah. So that's why I don't. I don't know. Yeah. Yet. Wow, that's cool,
and
man.
Dirty Walt's in there. You know, we didn't even know who Dirty Walt was actually.
Wow, that's yeah, because that's when I actually didn't notice it during Lethal Weapon. Uh-huh. It was when I heard Body Count on OG. I went back and saw Lethal Weapon. I don't know why. Like, hey, maybe it played on TV or something. Uh-huh. And I'm like, there they are. Like, that's probably Body Count, because there's no video for Body Count.
It's me in there.
Yeah,
it's me and Ice for the longest. You know, Ice and I, we're in Electric Boogaloo, like we said before. We're also in a movie called Rapping with Mario Van Peeble. And what makes that come around is Mario Van Peeble went backwards and got Ice to do New Jack City.
Okay.
And we did a movie with him called Rap, and he was rapping Robin Hood.
No, I don't know that one, man. I got to find that one.
And who else is in it is the Force MDs.
Oh, I remember Force MDs.
Yeah, Force MDs.
They had that one amazing song.
Tender Love.
Yeah, Tender Love.
They're in the video.
Oh, yeah. I love that song.
They're in the movie Rapping.
I have it on this iPhone. I have that track on a playlist on this iPhone.
They're in Rapping, so you know, go back and look that up.
I gotta find that, man. I didn't know
that's in 84, right? Yeah, around that same time with Canon Films. You know, when Canon Films was doing all these movies, you know.
I don't know that. Oh, that's cool, man. Yeah, like that was a thing about Ice-T. It's why I follow him on Twitter, right. Final Level, is because when I was growing up, more so than any other rapper, and I follow a few, but Ice-T for me is someone I can identify with who liked rap and
rock.
Yeah. I was the opposite. I'm coming from rock, and I like rap.
Right.
So he was from the rap game, and he embraced rock. And for me, that, I don't know, I just always found a common ground with him.
And his rap always has a good message to it. You know, the drug dealer gets killed at the end. You know what I mean? When you like go back to his stuff, you might have money and power and fame and this and that, but the drug dealer, you know, gets killed at the end.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So it all boils down. I always say, you know, Ice is, he's going to get a star. They're supposed to give it to him this year, but they'll give him a star on the Hollywood Boulevard. And I said, I want to speak. I don't speak a whole lot, but I wanted to speak. And all I wanted to say was, you know, the best word to describe him is integrity. That's the only word you can use, you know. And a lot of people don't have that. And some people don't even know what it is, you know, to have integrity. And if you don't know, you don't have it. So, but he, so he has it.
Right. Yeah, I've always thought he was. And then I went to see you guys play. I don't know, was it a year or two after Lollapalooza? You were on tour with a band called Hardcore.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And you guys played, and I can't remember the third band on the bill, because there's three bands.
Hardcore, and then it was, what's the name? We saw them this summer. Oh, what's the name of the band? Hardcore, and I can't think of the band. Yeah,
Hardcore.
That drummer auditioned to be in our band when our drummer passed. But you know, double bass is a tricky thing. Yeah. Man, double bass good is a tricky
thing. I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, it's tricky, very tricky.
You guys had just finished Lollapalooza, I think, because he was talking about Henry Rollins.
Propane. Yeah, and we played with them this summer.
Yeah, they're still gigging. I think we did a gig with them.
They were in Europe. Propane, that's the name of them.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That was the tour.
The guitar player got beat up in a club or something like that. You know, was out drinking. You know, that's why I quit drinking. You know, just because bad things happen.
Right. Yeah. So I always followed Body Count because I had this, I don't know, just. Affinity. I felt an affinity with you guys, and I thought it was so badass that Ice-T would. I mean, it's a risky move. I think hip hop is very close-minded in certain respects, and they don't let people move. You know, push the boundaries a little bit, and I thought Ice-T was really bold in doing that.
And the thing about, you know, he goes out and rap sometimes now, but it's old school. You know, because the rap has changed.
Yeah.
You know, but metal, it's like Led Zeppelin songs are still, I wish I could write Stairway to Heaven today. You know, it's timeless. You know what I mean? It doesn't change that much. You know, Like when we go out, they don't say the old school. We might say something else, but we're not an old school band. You know right. what I mean? We might have been around long enough, but they don't put that one more category for you, you know?
And what I find great about you guys is, speaking about that, is you do these phenomenal covers, like Bloodlust, Raining Blood. I mean, these are covers that are, no band can cover Institutionalized. Like, nobody can. No band, it's like covering Stairway to Heaven. You just don't do that because Mike Muir and ST perfected it. Who can do that? Oh, fucking Ice-T. You guys did a phenomenal cover version where you infused just as much of a comedic element to it.
But we looked at it from a more mature way.
Exactly.
You know, a little older. We're older, you know. We had to talk about something that, you know, people of our age talk about, you know. So your wife is complaining. but you know, but he really plays video games. It's not like you're trying to infuse something that you're not doing. Yeah, he plays video games. Yeah. That's what he does, you know. And, you know, so that's exactly it, you know. And then the sense of humor. You got to have a sense of humor. You can't, once you start taking this too seriously, you know, it's like, it's got to have a sense of humor to it, you know?
When I think we saw the video, like, in our dressing room on tour, we were like, you got to see this, you got to, someone said that. And I just watched it, like, with my mouth dry. It is fun.
It's funny. It's just funny, you know. And the vegans. I mean, that's our new record, Carnivore. We're gonna talk about the vegans, you know, because you gotta take it. You can't take it too serious. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know. So I always say, I'll eat anything that won't eat me first. So it's a race to who's gonna eat each other.
it's so hilarious. I mean, again, it's just like, it's just funny. It's,
you gotta have a sense. You gotta have a sense of humor when you know. I eat meat. You know, I could not eat meat, but I do. My grandbaby, she don't eat meat, but she's not on me trying to, you know, chastise me for eating meat, you know? Just let people do what they're going to do. As long as it's not interfering with you. Don't try to run other people's life. Run yours. If you run yours right, you're not worried about other people's life.
Right, right, right. And the other classic song nobody touches is Raining Blood. And again, I was listening to that, and I was like, I don't know what it is about you guys. You are it seems like you're the band that can take every classic song, cover it, and then and make it your own. Raining Blood's amazing.
Well, that wouldn't work. We tried the Led Zeppelin song, didn't work. But we try, you know. You gotta find the right fit, you know, in Ice's voice. Hey Joe. You hear us do Hey Joe?
No.
What the hell?
That's the first song I learned on guitar.
Oh, we did a cover on a Hendrix album. You know, Eric Clapton's on there. Slash is on it of Hey Joe. And the catch about it is, here's the funny kicker. So we did Hey Joe. Everybody did a song, you know. And I think Pat Metheny's on it also. And so we get a call from, I record the song here, and we sent it off. And we get a call from Eddie Kramer, you know. And Eddie Kramer says, hey, how you doing? You know, he says, I want to remix your song. So Ice goes, he's a joke. He says, you fucked up really bad because he wants to fix the song that you messed up, right? so and then he remixed it at Electric Ladyland, right?
Wow.
And so I said to him, I said, why did you pick us? You know, why, out of all the people, he had Slash, he had Eric Clapton, he had, you know, all these people. Yeah. I said, why did you pick us? He says, I think Jimmy would have liked you.
Oh, that's so nice.
I thought that was really nice. You know, left-handed. We had two left-handed guitars.
Right.
Not one. We had two left-handed guitars. I thought that was really cool.
And that's so cool.
There's certain moments like that I just kind of, I said, wow, that's, like you said, that's really nice. And that makes you, sometimes you got to just take a step back. I have like three moments like that in my life. Mm-hmm. When I was in the studio with Tony Iommi, Jeff Beck, and Brian May. You know, and I'm like, and I'm the producer, and they walk in, and I'm like, what? And Tony's asking me, Ernie, do I need to do that again? I'm like, why don't you ask?
But you need raps with the guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, why are you asking me? I'm like, as I saw, he says, act like you know. And the last one was, I was at the, what's the name of the thing? The Golden Gods. And my friend Big Dave, you know Big Dave? Anyway, he comes over to me and says, Ernie, Dave Grohl wants to meet you. I'm like, great. He wants to meet me? Wow. So I go meet him. And he says, I just wanted to meet you because, you know, in 1991 at Lollapalooza one more time, yeah. He says, Kurt and I were there. And he dug your band a whole lot. And we were getting ready. We had to leave. And he wanted to meet you. And he, you know, I never got a chance to meet him. Wow. I was like, wow. And it was like maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So he waited like 20 years to tell me this. Mm-hmm. And it must have popped in his head. That guy's in the room with me. Let me go, and I'm like, that's really nice of him to, yeah. To take that time to tell me that.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to that year, I saw you guys. Mm-hmm. And then I think I saw Nirvana a month later. On that Smells Like Nevermind tour.
Yeah, and I think Nirvana helped us out because they were just who they were. They weren't trying to be nobody else. You know what I mean? They weren't the part of the rock glam scene. They were just, you know.
I think it was Nirvana, but you guys I think it should be acknowledged that you guys doing this new thing, nobody had seen it. It wasn't a rap metal thing. It was a fucking metal band fronted by a rapper who. So, and with Nirvana, all these new versions of rock were coming out at the same time.
Right, exactly. I thought that was a good time because Rage came out. We came out before Rage. I saw Tom, he brought me to his rehearsal and sat me down in rehearsal and said, Ernie, listen to these songs and tell me which ones you like. It was his whole first record. I'm like, I'm done. I'm out of here. Because I put him on the first shows they did. They were our opening act for the longest. I always said, if you're going to be our open act, you get bigger than us. My first opening act was Stone Temple Pilots. I put them on, on my show.
Oh,
Mighty Joe Young. Scott used to rehearse next. I had Scott rehearse next to me. I got him his manager. I got them. My office to manage them,
We got to open for you then.
I said, anybody who opens for me gets bigger than me. Anybody who opens for me.
We just did our new records coming out in April, produced by Garth Richardson, who did the first Rage album.
Oh, Garth. Yeah.
Good Garth, yeah.
Because they rehearsed here in L.A. in downtown rehearsal.
Yeah.
And Tom gave me a cassette tape. With a matchbook on it. And that was to start the revolution. You're supposed to go burn down shit. I like him a lot. My Harvard graduated friend,
Yeah. Yeah, you can tell.
I'm like, oh, this is a good idea. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned it before, and I think we talked about it years ago. I brought it up with you when you were hanging out with us and I had to talk to you about Forbidden and producing Black Sabbath because there's a lot of people who have many distinctions with their, stellar careers, but there's only a few who can say that they produced Black Sabbath, and you are one of them. And how did that even happen?
Tony, on Ice's first record, he sampled War Pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony got a whiff of it, and he started listening to it, and he said he liked it. And then he, heard that I produced those first records that we did, and he just gave the office a call. And also, Miles Copeland helped out.
He's like
Stuart Copeland's brother. His brother. He ran IRS Records.
He managed
The police, Miles, helped get it together.
How did you get on his radar?
Because, I don't know. Because Tony listened to sample on there, and then he was like, started listening to our record and said, I like that. And then, then Miles came and said, I can get him. And,
oh, wow.
And then at that time, Warner Brothers wanted me to produce some records. They wanted me to do Tom Petty and Terrence Trent D'Arvy, and I was just like, I'm trying to do my band,
Wow.
And so I said, then they said Black Sabbath. I'm like, oh, I can take it. Hold on. Let me check this one out. So we were in England, and Tony came to our hotel, and what was so funny was a band called Take That was staying at the hotel.
Oh, Robbie Williams band, the boy band.
Yeah, the boy band. Yeah. It was girls all around for blocks and blocks. They had barricades out there, and Tony came in and said, "Boy, you guys are really popular." I'm like, we don't even know what's going on here. We could walk in and out of here. There's a bunch of little white girls around screaming. We're like, wow. Like, yeah. Yes. Tony's like, whoa.
That's amazing.
So anyway, he said, I would like you to do the record. I'm like, really? Okay, cool. And I showed up, and Cozy Powell was there, and you know, it was cool, you know.
Wow.
It was a good experience, you know. It was a rock and roll experience that you can just say, "Well, I did a Black Sabbath record, and I'm done," you know.
Yeah, you can pretty much.
Yeah, and it also made me say, yeah, I really don't want to produce bands that are already established. It's good to produce young people that listen.
I see.
And, right. And when you're so set in your ways, like it could have been hard for Putney. Putney to produce our record, you know what I mean? But we were open-minded, and I was aware of that. So I just totally stepped back. I was aware of where I got treated there. So I just kind of stepped back, hands off, let him do what he's going to do. I remember the greatest line he said to me. He's like, "Ernie, what was it like to do a record on 2-inch tape?" I'm like, "Really?" He said, "Must have took all year, huh?" I'm like, yeah.
When you think about it now, it's like, holy cow, how do you do that?
Yeah, but because the band used to play songs. I don't think I played a song in 2 years, the whole song all the way through.
It's the truth.
You know? Yeah, it's just bits and pieces, and it sounds good. You know, it was something to a disorganized, you know, loose record like that. You know, it has a certain feel that moves along, you know?
Yeah. And obviously, Ice-T's on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony was obviously cool with getting Ice on. Or where did that come from? From you or from Tony?
From me. I just said, "You're going to get Ice to rap on here?" He's like, "Yeah, let's get him on there." Tony was open. He was open to that. You know, he was open to it. He was just trying to do different things. And my whole thing with him was like, get together with Ozzy and hang out. And the next year they did the Ozfest.
Right.
So maybe it kind of went in his head, you know. And so it's good.
And how was it with Tony Martin?
Tony Martin, you know, he had to live in the footsteps of Dio, of Ozzy, so it's a hard shoe to fill, you know what I mean?
I would think it would be the same in your position, producing Black Sabbath at that time, the shadow of Volume 4 and Paranoid and Heaven and Hell.
I didn't pay that much attention to it. I was more Led Zeppelin, you know what I mean?
Right.
I loved Sabbath and this and that, but I wasn't diehard, you know what I mean?
That's good, though.
Yeah, that was good. I wasn't intimidated, you know what I mean? Because Tony wasn't going to play some guitars on some stuff. I stayed up all night and played all the guitars through the whole record. He came in the next day and said, I'll play that. So it made him, you know, sometimes, you know, you get to a point where you've been doing it for so long, you get kind of laid back, you know, and you forget that you gotta, what makes you popular is those guitar riffs that you're playing, you know?
Yeah, wow. I mean, I'm just so impressed about your production of Forbidden. I think it's such a feather in your cap.
You know, and the thing about that was, that was the time that Nirvana was out, and I told him, you know, I'm going to dry the sound up a little bit. You know, those records from the 80s were big records, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a few Sabbath records that have that. It's just too wet and juicy.
Yes. You're playing in a tunnel, playing at the end of a, you know.
You kind of lose perspective when you're in the studio and you think it's good.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I told him, I said, we're going to dry it up a little bit. Because Nirvana was dry. That's what made Nirvana sound. They were in your face. Mm-hmm. The record was, you know, like you got your ear against in some earphones because it's so dry in your face. It's not the big tunnel. Because I listen to Van Halen stuff. You got one guitar and one ear. And da 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 da. And, you know, it's big and large, but if they would have dried it up, I don't think they would have been that popular, maybe. You know? I don't know. It's something to that era that lends to, you almost seeing them on a stage and you're back in the seats, you know? And then Nirvana came along and made it more personal, like you're sitting down with someone.
Oh, that's a good way.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, that's a good way to
that's a rock star.
See it.
That's
yeah,
the rock
yeah.
star thing. The big wet sound is the rock star, the big rock star on stage. Like Queen, you can't touch them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're fragile and, you know, we're not hanging out with you because we don't look like we're going to hang out with you. But Nirvana made it more dried up in your face and we're going to sit down and, you know, come to my garage and listen to my band.
Yeah. But even that first Van Halen record and even like Unchained, for example, mm-hmm. it's wet and juicy, but for some reason, it's yeah. the tone is amazing.
Oh, the tone is great.
He's able to do it. But Tony Iommi, I think the juiciness, was it was just too much at times.
Right. It's still
part of the
song. Right. They're still doing that, you know, that rock star thing.
Yeah, And I think you're correct to just make it dry and in your face.
Yeah, so sit down with them. Sit down with the band, you know. The best band, like, there's a certain way that when you listen to bands in a club, they sound different than you listen to them in an arena, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? You know, mm-hmm. so that made it more club sounding.
Yeah. So you've got, the last record was Bloodlust, mm-hmm. and there's all the, I mean, great guests by Mustaine and Randy from...
Right.
And Lamb of God and of course Max
right.
Cavalera. This Carnivore record that mm-hmm. you've mentioned, mm-hmm. are you in the middle of songwriting?
No, we're just starting. You know, we're just starting. We're gonna play tomorrow, then we're gonna start writing the record. You know, Ice is gonna be off in the summer, so we'll be all ready for the summer. You know, we're not gonna tour. We only got a couple of dates in Europe this summer, and we'll write a record. That's the way we do things. We just write during the summer because he shoots all you know during the year.
You're right. Yeah, I think we're playing the same festival.
Oh, we are?
But it's a different day.
Always different days.
I had to say that to someone else yesterday. I'm like, we're playing, it's a different day.
Always different days.
Yeah,
you know?
It sucks.
I love the festivals in Europe.
Yeah,
you know?
I love it too.
Yeah,
it's
special.
Yeah. Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about is like our album, uh-huh. you know, it's called A Rock Supreme. Uh-huh. We come up with the album title at the end of the entire process. But I noticed that Ice... sends out the album title.
That's like, where we did the band. We came up with the name before we had a band. He sends it out to see does it catch any attention. If people start asking about it so he can explain it. Because we came up with Body Count before we had a band. He said your band's going to be Body Count. I'm like, why? He said, I said it at Warner Brothers. They liked it.
Really?
He said, I got this band I'm working with called Body Count. And everybody goes, Body Count? Body count. Okay, cool. I'm body count.
So Carnivore really kind of sets the tone. He's saying like, you guys are saying like, me like, fuck vegans with tongue in
right,
cheek.
Right.
But now that kind of just set the stage for all the lyrics.
It's going to be, it sets the stage for everything. So we got to see how... people come at it because people are going to come up with their own ideas. You know what I mean? Is it about... And then you're like, no, it's not, but it might be now. Because manslaughter is about, you know, men becoming wimps, you know what I mean, over the years. That's what that's about.
Oh,
you know?
Okay, okay.
It's not about, you know, it's about men just, you know, losing their balls, you know? That's what manslaughter is.
Oh, that's great. So that's so... I don't know anybody who does that.
Yeah, do it in reverse. Because people will help you out. You know, your fans will help you out. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're like, oh, it's Carnivore. Yeah. And they'll start saying what they think it is. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I noticed Ice is, I love the thing about following Ice-T on Twitter is he does something a lot of guys in his position don't do, which is just basically... You're coming at me?
Huh?
I'm coming at you, too.
He likes that. He likes that kind of thing.
I love it, man.
I did that one time. Somebody said something to me, and I started getting into him back and forth with him. And they said, if you had any kind of manager, he wouldn't be letting you talk back and forth to me. I'm like, what? You know, people like that.
That pissed me. I've gotten that too, man.
You
got
that one?
Me off.
I was just like, I am so done with this.
I love how he comes back with like, also he's got an army of followers who will just go, fuck that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He just has to point. I'll be one of them, man. You know? So there's that. That helps him out a bit. But it's so funny. To And then you look at the guy who dared tweet this at him, and he's got like 13 followers.
Yeah, but that made him. That's it. That made his day.
It's true.
He replies like, to him, you know.
Here's Ice-T. Yeah. Going back to a guy who's like probably his mom and his cousin follow him.
Right.
Who cares, man?
More people know him from Law and Order than they do from music.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. You know, and when the 20-something-year-old kids. I remember somebody coming backstage. These kids come backstage and says, "It's the guy from Law and Order. He has a band." I'm like, "What the hell?" And then one kid said to me, he says, "You know that song Cop Killer? Y'all should put it out." I'm like, he's 20-something.
Wow, that's kind of crazy.
We wrote that song 28 years ago now.
Yeah.
So the 20-somethings, that's all they know.
Yeah. I can see that. That's
it puts it in perspective, but at the same time, you know, Bloodlust was one of the heaviest albums that came out last year, I thought.
It came out really good. We thought it came out really good. Plus, the band's getting better. You know, mm-hmm. We put Juan in the band, and the band's able to be a band, you know. Because, like I've said, I've had 8 different combinations of this band. You know, mm-hmm. People passing, this and that. And the only two that worked was the first one and this one. Mm. Just the only two combinations that worked.
What happened between... There's an 8-year period between Manslaughter and the one before it.
I was tired to take off time because I lost so many people, and maybe we rushed into it too fast. You know what I mean? Because like when my drummer passed, when we were like invincible, everything was going great. Right. He passed in the back of it, and then he passed. You know, the craziest thing that you ever hear in your life. Is like you're at a funeral. You're mourning someone in your band, and someone walks up to you and says, "Hey, man, you know I play the drums. Here's my card." You know.
Whoa.
And I said, "Yeah, you know who I won't be getting to play the drums." Yeah. You know. So I was just like, "Okay." Then Moose got shot, but Moose wasn't in the band when he got shot. Moose was playing for Iggy Pop. I was going to get him back in the band. Me and him used to fight like cats and dogs, but that was part of the band.
Yeah.
He wanted to be in charge, and you know. But that's part of the band. That would made the band. You
right,
know? That
right.
made it a real band. And he got killed, and we had another bass player in the band that thumped a whole lot, and that didn't exactly work a whole lot.
Yeah.
And then my after Moose got killed, then then D-Rock passed, you know, like some years later. He was my dear friend. And to make it simple, I got my guitar tech, who was my friend, to play the guitar. Instead of looking for the right person, I just got who was convenient.
Right, yeah.
It was convenient. But by making it convenient, the band didn't work. You know what I mean? So this time around, when I started the band back, I said, I'm going to start the band back. I quit drinking. I wasn't sad. I thought it was time to do the band again. I said, I'm going to do the band. I'm going to start it back up. I decided not to get that other guitar player and got Juan. You know, we auditioned some people, and then I said, let me try Juan out. And got over the color thing, like I said before.
Mm-hmm.
And put Juan in the band, and then just no matter what people say, whatever, you know, this is who we are. We're Body Count. This is Body Count now.
Yeah.
And it works. And the thing about it is, people have accepted him. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
People accept
him.
Because he's from Evil Dead. You know, he's been around. And people accept him. You know. He's right. He's the right fit. He's the exact, and it makes the band. When we go to rehearsals, we have a good time. Again, you know, it's joking. I get to sit back because I don't want to run things. I just get to sit back. My bass player runs things. That's fine with me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, Ernie, this has been great, man. I've been wanting to have you on the podcast. It's just that you're in LA and I'm in Toronto.
When I did, I enjoyed being here with you because, you know, just looking at you and just, you know, it's different from on the phone. You know, I like it's real personal.
That's good.
That shirt you said is Don Knotts, like the real Don Knotts?
Yeah, it's a Danzig skull
right.
And the Danzig font, but it says Don Knotts.
Yeah, you have to deliver it to Don Knotts. You know when I talk about I was delivering scripts and things like that for the company that I met? I used to deliver to Don Knotts, Warren Beatty, you know, I was always Warren Beatty. I delivered to him up on in Beverly Hills, and he would be like, "Come on in, have a seat." I'm like,
"Are you serious?"
I'm working. Yeah, I used to deliver scripts and things like that.
Okay, because
Don Knotts lived on. He lived in Beverly Glen. Yeah, I used to deliver to him.
I have a other podcast called the Regal Beagle Podcast. Uh-huh. It's just about Three's Company.
Uh-huh.
So we watch an episode and we talk about it. So I'm a huge Don Knotts fan. Do you have a Don Knotts story?
No, he was just always nice. You know, like, I used to just deliver packages to him, like the scripts. And I used to, you know, he lived up in the condo, like, right near Santa Monica. Not too far, in Santa Monica. But, you know, what I found out, like, some of the actors that you think lived in big mansions. Like, yeah. one actor that was on the show with Valerie Bertinelli. What's the name of that show?
One Day at a Time.
One Day at a Time. One of the actors on there, I thought he would live in a big mansion.
Schneider?
Schneider, yeah. I thought he lived in a big mansion, right? He lived in the back house on the big mansion.
You know? Really?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, so I used to deliver.
It's all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, I used to deliver to a whole lot of folks. I used to deliver to Larry Graham. But then Larry,
you give him a tape?
But no, but here's the funny thing. One time I was a Jehovah's Witness. You know? Larry Graham is how Prince became a Jehovah's Witness. He's Brother Graham.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's why Prince was a Jehovah's Witness, because of Larry Graham.
I knew Prince was, but I didn't know because of Larry Graham.
Larry Graham is a circuit overseer.
Oh, wow.
Big time. It's delivered to Brother Graham. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I never asked you, how did you know Sly Stone?
I used to steal houses, and...
Did you say steal whore?
Yeah. I had a friend who was a great real estate guy, and he would move our family into a house.
Right.
And then he would sell the house. He didn't own the house, but he would sell the house and say, this family needs $10,000 on top of the mortgage to move. He'll take the $10,000, move us somewhere else, and we'd just sit in the house. Steal houses.
Right.
Wow. He can't steal a whole house. Sly lived in one of the houses. He moved into the house. My friend knew him. He moved into the house. Wake up at 4 in the morning with drum machines and stuff like that. And then he went into treatment.
Right.
To Cry Help, which I went to, and you know, Robert Downey went to. There's no secret, I can say it out loud. You know, mm-hmm. Robert will talk about it himself.
Yeah.
But and Sly left there, and that's, you know, still probably not sober to this day. Some people are just designed to be high.
It's just amazing, because when I think of Sly Stone and the albums, and then I have to remind myself, he's still alive and still capable mm-hmm. of making like albums, but he's not.
You know, Larry Graham was his bass player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, real quick, in high school, I used to go around the corner from my high school, which was Crenshaw, with the Brothers Johnson went there. You know,
Brothers Johnson.
But they were the Brothers Johnson plus one, because their cousin used to play in the band, Alex Weir. And I used to go around the corner to this place called The Total Experience. I sat down and saw, because we go there at lunchtime, Donnie Hathaway, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, the Gap Band, DJ Rogers. But so that's my upbringing listen to all these good R&B artists. You know, Michael Henderson. You know, Michael Henderson is a bass player. He's a songwriter. He wrote for the Dramatics. Plays bass for Miles Davis.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. Wow. No, heavy stuff, man. Yeah. Because you mentioned, I know Sly Stone, and then we just kept talking.
But, you know, on a music thing, my high school drum major was James Bradley Jr. In high school, he played on It Feels So Good by Chuck Mangione in high school.
Whoa.
And he's still around.
I'm not a big Chuck Mangione fan, but I...
Yeah, in high school, that's
what that album was.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
And
you couldn't go anywhere without hearing.
And I knew all the guys from Rolls Royce, you know. Rolls Royce. Car wash.
Right.
Car wash. Those guys. The funk. Our high school was called the Funk High School because everybody knew how to play funk. You know, right. Funk is a lost art. You know, with playing. I mean, just little cute little guitar stuff. Like when you listen to a song like, this is a whole another podcast. You listen to a song like Cut the Cake by Average White Band. Little cute little guitar funk parts, you know. Mm-hmm. That, funk is different now. Funk, the way you play is different now. But it used to be little cliches, they call them on the guitar.
I know exactly what you mean by that.
Right.
Yeah.
Just
that
little
description.
And last thing. I got to tell you, one last thing. Okay, so I grew up in South Central LA. There's a place here called the Fabulous Forum. You know, it's the Staples Center. It's where the Lakers play. Okay. Where the Lakers used to play. They call it the house that Jack built, because a guy named Jack Kent Cook built it, right? And the first concert I ever went to in my life, 1974, 73, Isley Brothers, BT Express, and I think Peebo Bryson. Yeah, People Bryson, because he had Reaching for the Stars, Reaching for the Sky and all that. Okay, so I went to the concert, you know. This year, on the 31st, the last show of the year, I played the Forum, because we opened for Ozzy on New Year's. And I sat in there, and the guy said to me, what do you want to play for sound check, right? I'm in the Forum. I don't know if you saw this picture. I'm in the Forum.
Right.
I said, what do you want to play for sound check? I started playing Who's That Lady.
So cool, man.
Ozzy Brothers.
That's so cool.
I felt 14 years old.
That's amazing, man. That's cool. Amazing. Cool. This has been awesome, Ernie. This is exactly the conversation I had hoped and pictured in my head, and it's even
and one
better.
Last one. Yeah, we, you know, last year was for the band was technically the best year ever. You know, we played the Grammys. Mm-hmm. We played the Grammy. We got nominated for a Grammy. First time ever, you know, we got nominated for a Grammy, and we played the Grammys, and we were just like, okay, this is. Way out, you know, and then finish the year by playing the Forum. So I don't know what else. I don't know what else I can do here.
Fuck vegans. we
love the vegans, though.
Same here, man. I'm almost there.
We're not going to beat up Moby or anything like that.
Personally speaking, I'm actually almost there.
When Ice did an interview about, because he was talking about doing it last summer, right? And someone says, Moby's going to be upset. And we're like, Moby? Are we not worried about Moby? I worry about getting The Rock upset. It's like, The Rock is after, I'm going to quit eating meat. You know?
It's not carnivore anymore.
Right.
Yeah, no, I get it. Oh, that's so funny. Anyway,
cool.
Great, man. Thanks, Ernie, man. Thanks for this.
You have a good trip back.
All these people out here tripping off of police brutality.